Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would it take to forge a personal identity if your formative years were split between two cultures that seem a world apart? My guest today is the product of a highly unlikely union. Days after her 19-year-old Bedouin father left behind a largely traditional lifestyle to study English, he met her mother, a lifelong native of rural Washington State. Despite language and cultural barriers, the two fell in love and had two children before Almaria's father returned home, sending for his wife and daughters a few years later, beginning what for her would be a childhood divided between two vastly different ways of life. Today, Sophia Almaria is a writer, artist, and filmmaker. She shares the story of her remarkable youth in her new memoir, The Girl Who Fell to Earth. Sophia, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Start, if you would, by telling us a little about your father's boyhood, because it seems he was born into a generation that would ultimately sort of straddle two entirely different ways of life, even if they never left home.
That's right. It's a very common story in the Gulf of my father's generation, who really made this massive leap between. There's a sort of legion of young men who were sent to America and Europe in the 70s and 80s, and so his story is really one of many. And so as a result, there are, in fact, coming out of the woodwork all the time, I'm meeting other kids from similar situations who are all around the same age. So it's a sort of mini... cross-cultural phenomenon that happened, which is common, I guess, you know, in all kinds of sort of international migrations.
And what was daily life like for him as a kid?
It was pretty rugged. I mean, he grew up barefoot and very, I mean, the stories that he tells are, they seem like they're from a very different time than it was. You know, he grew up in the 60s, and it sounds like it was, you know, the way of life was really unchanged since ancient times. I mean, they were living a true Bedouin lifestyle up until he was around 11 or 12, and he started going to school in the city. But they would actually ride in with the postman and go into Riyadh and then go back on the weekends to see their family in the village they had moved into by that point.
And so when he arrived in Seattle, he spoke very little English. Is that right?
No English. It was nominal. He has a lot of very funny stories about trying to get by with next to nothing. Not only was English a problem, but it was also, you know, basic sort of survival skills like being able to understand signage and packaging. You know, he goes into a store and thinks that a bottle of Tide is cereal. So... there's a lot of sort of funny situations like that.
Yeah, it's funny you tell that story. He thought he was buying cornflakes, and he rips the box open and realizes, I cannot eat this.
Yeah, there's several like that. I mean, also, at one point, he bought a microwave thinking it was a television and had to figure that one out the hard way when the remote control didn't work.
So how does your mother describe her initial attraction to him? This stranger who spoke no English that walked into, I guess it was like a bowling alley?
Yeah, it was a bowling alley in Tacoma in Washington State. And she was attracted to, he was, you know, she'd grown up around, you know, guys who were, you know, into motorcycles and farm type guys as well, and very American, sort of stereotypical American dudes. And along came this really awkward pink suit wearing man with a mustache who looked, you know, who didn't seem to know his way around very well. He was sort of this innocent. That was something quite new for her.
You know, it's hard for me to imagine falling in love with someone when there was such a language barrier. But you, when you were sort of having to learn a second language, have dealt with learning to communicate with people who don't share your language at the time. Can you talk a little bit about the ways that, people make that work when common words don't exist for them?
Body language and awkward hand gesturing, I think, mm-hmm. is really key in that situation. I think it's, you know, there isn't really any handbook for you know, a languageless understanding, and that just sometimes happens with people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Certain people are really good at communicating beyond beyond the sort of conventional modes of polite conversation. My father is definitely one of those people. He really understands, you know, animals, and I think that really folded over into being able to, I mean, my mother as well, having grown up with animals, I think they were both sort of like, in a way, even though they were very, very different childhoods that the two of them had, they were, they had certain similarities that they could sort of have some kind of simpatico understanding.
That's a really fascinating observation, yeah, that you learn to read the body language of animals and their eyes and sort of what they might be thinking in the same way, on a different level, perhaps, that you'd read another person.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I mean, that's something they both talk about, so.
How did they leave things in terms of their relationship? You had been born, your sister had been born, they were married when your father returned to Qatar.
Yes, that's right. They, you know, these things are always hazy in relationships, I think, a lot of times. And this is also all from my sort of, obviously, I don't have firsthand memories of when I was 3 years old or 4 years old, but these are all stories that I've, like, that section of the book is predominantly made up of stories that I've heard, not just stories, but, you know, in conversation, in argument, in all of these things. So sort of history of that time has been by both sides, and as it's been ironed out over the years, because it was a very difficult sort of period of time for my mother being left in the States and for my father sort of being with his family. And then eventually having he married his second wife. You know, it was a very complicated, very dramatic time, and as a result, there are a lot of crazy stories that happened during that period, and a lot of emotion. So, I did my best to sort of iron that out in the story and do it justice, because I think it's a triumph on both of their parts that they're still together and
yeah.
We're still together as a family.
It comes, I think, as much as a surprise to us as readers as it must have to your mother to discover that your father had taken a second wife, that she didn't know this. He sent for the family, is that right? And you went to reunite with him. And then sort of from the start, things were a bit different than what you had all expected.
Yeah. There still is, I think, for a lot of people who moved to the Gulf, to the Arabian Gulf or the Persian Gulf, but there's this sort of allure of good living, you know, and living in many cases beyond one's means. And there was this sort of promise in the late 80s when we moved back there, you know, that we would be living much better than we were in America at the time. I mean, we were, you know, at good times living in a tiny, you know, apartment block and, you know, or living with our grandmother. So moving into this big sort of glass tower in Abu Dhabi, it was actually Abu Dhabi, but for streamlining, it's Doha in the book, into these big, you know, glass towers with this beautiful long corniche with palm trees and, you know, fancy cars everywhere and beaches and big hotels. It all seemed very sort of, you know, glamorous and good schools and all these kinds of things, you know, private schools. And so these were all things that were not available to us in America. And so that was a big reason, I think, that we wanted to go, aside from being, my mother, you know, missed my father. We missed my father very much. And she had not met my father's family yet at that time. So it was quite a dramatic event when we went back there.
It was also interesting to me that your mother, this woman who had been sort of open enough in her outlook on the world to approach your father when they first met, found herself when you were in, I guess, what was Abu Dhabi, unable to speak to, say, immigrant laborers, because that was looked upon as something that was completely improper.
Yeah, I mean, that didn't stop her. Now when she goes back, she's very, she's very American in that way. This is one of the great things, I think, is that there's not that sort of social, like, imposed social, over-awareness about social class, or in some cases, I mean, in the Gulf, it really sort of manifests itself like a caste system in a way, except it's not, all one sort of population that's, from the same place. But she, that's something that we really learned from her, was to sort of reject that order in a lot of ways, because it is quite a cruel and grinding thing in the Gulf.
So you knew before your mother knew that your father had another wife?
Yes.
Tell us about what happened.
We met her, and there was just, it's one of these things that sometimes you realize in retrospect that you met someone, or someone was, it was a very sort of, in my memory, it comes across as a very sort of almost cinematic moment of realization, of sort of epiphany.
Mm-hmm.
When I met my little brother, Amr, and she's an incredibly kind and very, I'm going to say the word very, very simple, but not in the way that it might sound. But, like, she loves her children. She loves my father. She loves, by default, then she very much sort of expresses love towards my sister and I. And that her life is her family, and that is a very different. It's the same. It's the same love that my mother has for us, obviously, but similar. It's difficult to explain, I think, to when people ask me what the relationship is like with her. It's sometimes difficult to explain, because I know that there are many stories in which similar situations where it's just completely unreconcilable. But with our situation, I think that there was a sort of, like an understanding between her and my mother. She was also very young when she married my father, and it was just a very different cultural situation. She was also from a Bedouin family. She had never gone to school ever. It's just a very different perspective on the world. And so, when my mother saw that she really meant her no harm and didn't understand what was wrong about the situation, in reverse, my mother sort of started to come around to understanding her perspective as well. And that's been an ongoing conversation over the years. I mean, it's been back and forth.
Sophia Almeria is my guest. She's a writer, artist, and filmmaker. Her new memoir is called The Girl Who Fell to Earth. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes and invite you to join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer, artist, and filmmaker Sophia Almeria. Her new memoir is called The Girl Who Fell to Earth. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Sophia, one of the most moving things, I think, in that section of the book where your mother and you and your sister are discovering there is this other part of the family that you hadn't known is that your father was truly crestfallen because he thought your mom would be delighted that she had company in the apartment and that he had almost taken a second wife, thinking of her as much as himself.
Yeah, I think that's a testament to his complete sort of naivety and in a way, I mean, I was talking about that sort of animal way of communication of just sort of understanding, but that's one of those sort of social situations that just don't translate at all, which was, I think, comes across kind of funny in the book, but at the time it was certainly mother blew her top.
I got that part, too. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So you went back ultimately to Washington State. What did your classmates, your neighbors, what did other people know about this aspect of your life?
Well, I think that there, to a certain extent, people didn't really want to know. I mean, I think it was something that was so sort of to friends and family, we were normal American kids, accepted into the community for the most part. And aside from, you know, your typical sort of rural America weird situations, which everybody has to deal with at some point in their lives, if you're even a little bit brown or different looking. You know, there was, I guess, mild curiosity growing up, but really it wasn't something that we sort of displayed. I remember one time going into class with a actually I won't tell the story.
Okay.
but it's an interesting thing. I think it's very common for kids growing up in the States.
Talk about this. You had a teacher who said, who was teaching a lesson about the Persian Gulf, and you sort of raised your hand and said, excuse me, but it's the Arabian Gulf.
Yeah, it's a funny thing because in the Arabic curriculum schools that I had gone to in the Gulf, of course, in Arabic it says, Khalija Arabi, and that means the Arabian Gulf, and that's sort of, I was taking it through literal translation, and so I mean, similarly, when I was in the Arabic curriculum school in Abu Dhabi, when they were doing, you know, the ABCs and they would sing it with a different tune, I would raise my hand like a little jerk and say, actually, this isn't how you sing it. You know, so it's a, sort of that age when you're sort of proving yourself. In my case, it happened to be proving oneself culturally to, you know, your teachers or to your peers. And, you know, that is a much larger political question about whether you consider it the Persian or the Arabian Gulf, but, you know, that goes back centuries. But yeah, that was just one of many sort of strange situations that popped up.
You write about your mother's experiences, although she and your father, as you said, are still together. After that initial visit, she came back and was sort of less trusting of a lot of people and things. She was, in some cases, you describe her as almost paranoid about potential threats to you and your sister. How did that affect the way she parented you?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
You write about the fact that when you returned to Washington State, initially your mother, who was sort of reeling from this discovery that she ultimately would come to terms with, was a little bit paranoid about the threats in the world and things that could harm you and your sister, and she was worried about a lot. Can you talk about how that affected the way she parented you?
Yes, she just became very overprotecting and very strict. In a way, she sort of became the surrogate for the place that I guess traditionally you might imagine an Arab father would take of, you know, not allowing us to leave the house, you know, past a certain time, or, you know, actually things that are quite reasonable in the scheme of things. But when you're, you know, 12 years old or 13 years old, seem completely ridiculous. You know, you want to walk home at 5 o'clock in the afternoon and be a problem. But there are a lot of threats out there, and they just seemed sort of exaggerated in her mind, because we were everything that she had in her life at that time, and she was very much a sort of bare mother. Like she was very, or I guess what do they call it, tiger mother,
yeah,
in a way. Very tough on us, which was good.
So, like a lot of pre-adolescent and adolescent kids do, you started keeping your innermost thoughts in a journal, which is sort of like the gun in the first act in a Chekhov play, right? You know it has to go off by the third act. That diary was going
That's
to get
cruel.
Discovered, right? It was going to get read. And there were some pretty significant consequences for you.
Yeah. I mean, it began certainly as a sort of innocent exercise in figuring out what sex was, you know, what all the things that I couldn't talk to anyone about, all the questions you always wanted to ask but never could, that kind of a, you know, document. And of course, that's the sort of ultimate taboo thing for a young woman, and especially a young woman who's growing up in a sort of even... I mean, even though we were in the States at that time, I was actually going back quite regularly. So it was sort of like the ultimate taboo for me to be thinking about. And of course, my mother thought that it was too early, and that ended up in her deciding to send me back to live with my extended family. And that was, you know, a really huge sort of turning point in my life, because I suddenly had a life that was not anchored to either of my parents, because my father wasn't there around the family when I went back to Doha. And so that happened it was quite a liberating experience, actually, to go at that young age and sort of try to make a place for myself within the tribe.
And one of the things you had to do was to navigate and learn to understand what to a Western observer seems like a sort of Byzantine system of familial relationships, and everybody's called a cousin, and somebody is your sort of milk mother. Talk a little bit about the process that you went through figuring out, A, who you were, you know, sort of related to by blood as opposed to by marriage, and B, what they all meant to you.
It's a process that, I mean, it's incredibly difficult to figure out, you know, when you're suddenly faced with a sort of gaggle of 20 kids and figure out who all of them are. And most of them are brothers and sisters or cousins, so everybody kind of looks the same, and you're coming into it completely fresh. You're sort of dropped into it like a, like a fish. And luckily, that happened when I was young enough. The only way that I was actually ever really able to figure it out was to draw this, as you say, Byzantine family tree. It was this, you know, incredibly large sort of flowchart of explanation for myself, a sort of guide, because, I'm not an OCD person, but I needed some kind of solid thing to be able to understand who everyone is, because there's 14 uncles and aunts in total. I mean, including my father, there's 14 from my grandfather, and then each of them have 10 kids, and each of them have kids, and so it's quite a large thing to try to work through, very old-fashioned in that way.
Talk about where you lived at this point, because the family had sort of made the transition from a traditional Bedouin lifestyle. They were living in a city in, I guess, government-issued housing?
That's correct. What happened a lot in the 70s when both Saudi and Qatar and the Emirates were moving people out of the desert was they would sort of set up these large projects. Some of them would be apartments, but others would be these sort of allocated houses, these sort of folk houses that would have, five rooms and a living room for the women and a living room for the men and an exterior kitchen. And these things often get built onto as well, so they turn into these sort of, endless projects. And I remember actually the house that we were in, someone had knocked a hole in the wall so that they could go through to the next house. and so as kids, we could just jump through this, like, really jagged hole in a brick wall to get over to our aunt's house. And then it was just this sort of extension. So it was like this mansion, really, but it was actually kind of terrible living situation because there were just so many people in the house on top of each other. But everyone was, you know, it was that kind of thing is really fun when you're a kid. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, and things were initially sort of allowances were made because you were new and you had come from the U.S. And then suddenly things really changed as you reached adolescence and you were expected to live according to the sort of standards of modesty and sex segregation that the rest of your family lived according to.
Yeah. It's actually interesting because this is something that even to this day I still sort of wrestle with, in my professional life and my working sort of situations in the Gulf. And it's in some ways, you know, wearing abaya and shela gave me a lot of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that is also addressed in the book where in a strange way it was sort of donning this invisibility cloak of being able to fit in, which is something that I desperately wanted, especially when I was a teenager. It's an incredibly complex question that the book, kind of barely touches on in a way. I mean, it's a major point of writing this, the project of this book, is to sort of try to navigate what it means to have these expectations layered on top of you and how to free yourself from those expectations and also have expectations for yourself external to that, finding an identity that doesn't rely on either the American or the Qatari or the Arab sort of ideals.
It's funny when you describe later in your teenage years going to school and you would have sort of layer upon layer that sort of reflects who you were as a person.
Yeah, it was a very much a chrysalis situation, or like a sort of some kind of twisted striptease, I guess. Actually, because I would leave the house and I would have and have my face covered. I'd throw the shela up over my face so that the neighbors wouldn't see which of the girls that I was, and then I would get to school and take my abaya off, and then be wearing jeans and Converse and my David Bowie t-shirt, and that would be completely normal, and then I would walk back the other way.
And put everything all back on again.
Put it all back on again, yeah. So it was very, and a lot of girls also did that, a lot of girls who were not, not halfies, but it was very common to, be one person or be dressed in one way at school and then switch change.
Halfie,
so like a magic act.
Is that the term that you sort of coined for yourself?
The term that people use from different cultures, isn't it? Like a
mixed race or mixed ethnicity.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I've some Chinese friends in the States who always call themselves halfies as well. So I think it's just a sort of easy slang. And someone the other day was bringing up this term third culture kid as well, which is a very 50s thing, but sort of the term for kids who grow up outside of the cultures that they're technically from. But there's yet to be a phrase.
It seems like a lot of people who grow up navigating two cultures or even more cultures are sort of in their youth always looking for which one fits better, and then ultimately come to a place where they decide that they don't have to choose exactly. Is that what you were working through when you were in high school and in college?
Yeah, I mean, I think that having to choose is a mistake. I think, or thinking that you have to choose is a mistake because, you know, you're thrown from your earliest sort of formative times into a difficult situation, really, if, I mean, everybody is who's born, but I think in a big way, I mean, the moral of the story in this book is that one should rebel against this idea that you have to be one or the other and forge some other island for yourself, whether that is through, I mean, in the case of this book, it, you know, I find a way through, you know, things like, you know, pop culture and books and music and ideas, and that really helped. And I think, yeah, sort of building a raft of a sort of surrogate world for yourself is, I think, a very comforting thing.
What do you think you represented for the cousins and the half-siblings in the house who maybe looked at you as the closest link they had to someone in the West?
I mean, when my cousins and my aunts and, you know, started getting interested in, say, like, I don't know, the Backstreet Boys, then it was, you know, quite exciting because they'd be like, oh, do you know so-and-so? Do you ever see them in the street? And, you know, have you ever seen Leonardo DiCaprio? That kind of a thing, you know, they think America is, you know, a tiny town. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was a sort of, you know, there's a sort of pop cultural idea of what being American might represent. But, you know, that was another thing that we were able to bond over is things like, you know, horror films and, you know, watching movies and listening to music as kids was a really important bonding experience for me with my cousins, also listening to music, you know, learning dances and that kind of thing was really key to having, like, lasting relationships with them.
Sophia Almeria is my guest. She's a writer, artist, and filmmaker with a new memoir called The Girl Who Fell to Earth. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer, artist, and filmmaker Sophia Almeria. Her new memoir is called The Girl Who Fell to Earth. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Sophia, you had some really interesting experiences with your uncle who had the, I guess, misfortune of falling in love with a young woman who was not the person who either family chose for each other. In other words, this was sort of a girlfriend he had, but not the woman he was prescribed to marry. Okay, we have to call her right back. My guest this hour is writer, artist, and filmmaker Sophia Almeria. Her memoir is called The Girl Who Fell to Earth. If you would like to ask a question or call us, 1-800-933-5372 is the telephone number, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Again, we're speaking on the phone with her today from Morocco, and we've had some issues with the phone lines. It looks like we are bringing her back online now. Sophia, are you with us?
Yes.
Okay, great. I was asking about your experiences with your uncle who had what turned out to be the misfortune of falling in love with a young woman who was not the woman he would be marrying in a few short weeks. Can you talk a little bit about that and sort of what, from your perspective, you were able to observe about that relationship?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of the one of the oldest stories ever told. You know, it's a very Romeo and Juliet situation, and for me as a dramatic teenager, it was quite exciting to be witnessing it and being the sort of go-between.
You were like the accomplice
in that relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very much a sort of accomplice, and it, you know, there's a lot of sort of very humorous memories of helping him to see her and to, you know, sneak around. And I think one thing is that it really sort of illustrated for me the sort of impossibility, really, for a lot of people, and how lucky I was. The impossibility for a lot of people to escape norms and sort of expectations of them by their families. And I think that that's a very fairly universal story, whether it's in, you know, the basic sort of thing in terms of who you're going to marry, or whether it's, you know, the tremendous pressure of what you're going to do with your life, or, you know, I feel I very much was lucky to be able to sort of slip through the cracks of expectation in that way.
And one thing you describe as part of those scenes is these things that occur called family days, which I didn't know anything about, that are really interesting. Can you tell us about what happens on these days?
Family day. Well, essentially what family day is in the Gulf is it, you know, once a week. And in the case of, say, you know, swimming pools, sometimes it'll be many more times a week. But public spaces are sort of sealed off, so they become female-only zones for women and young children. And so that they can, you know, go to the mall in peace without being, you know, harassed by young men, or so that their overpossessive husbands won't, you know, worry about them running into someone, falling desperately in love and running away.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that, I mean, that's an extreme and very dramatic example.
Right.
But yeah, so essentially there are these sort of transference of public space into private space, which is really interesting. And but actually it's taken on a sort of weirdly political vibe in sort of recent years. I've noticed a lot of conversation about workers, laborers, especially on Fridays being sort of kicked out of places when it's their only day off. And that kind of thing. There's still a lot to be worked out in terms of, you know, there is a gender, essentially apartheid, that still exists in the Gulf, and also a social one in terms of, you know, the rich and the very poor. So all those things manifest themselves, especially in public spaces there, basically.
When you went to college, you sort of suffered from, I was surprised that even in a place like Egypt, lots of people think, oh, if you are a Gulf Arab, you must come from a wealthy family, therefore you don't get financial aid, that sort of thing. Can you talk about even sort of within the region, coping with stereotypes about people assuming they knew who you were and what you were?
Yeah, Egypt was a huge eye-opener for me. In terms of what, I mean, even I had gone to school with people from all over the region, you know, Palestinians, Egyptians, Iraqis, and they, you know, they even existed outside of that. In, you know, back in Egypt, kids who had grown up, Egyptians who had grown up in the Gulf, even had, you know, their own stereotypes to deal with when they went back to Cairo or to go to university, which is a very common sort of trajectory. So, yeah, I mean, there are stereotypes about money, about sort of being spoiled, about not really understanding the real world. All of those things might be true. You know, for some people, in my situation, it certainly was certainly not the case. And so, as a result, my experience of Cairo and really coming of age in Egypt was, you know, very unusual, and I think very, I wouldn't have traded it for the world. I wanted to go to NYU or go to film school, and I wouldn't have traded going to Egypt for anything now, because it was an incredibly formative experience.
How fluent was your Arabic at the time you started college?
Well, by the time I got to college, I was very fluent in terms of sort of domestic language, you know, like the language that you use with your family, very, you know, talk.
Yeah.
But in terms of book learning, if you will, it was difficult. And it's an incredibly difficult language to learn because there are so many different iterations of it. I mean, it's notoriously so. You have the, you know, classical Arabic, modern standard Arabic. You have the Arabic that you would use in Egypt on the street, Amia, which is completely different from anything that I would ever use in the Gulf or anywhere else for that matter. So it can be quite a confusing thing if you don't have a sort of clear idea. I think the first time that I turned up there, I asked the cab driver to shut the window, and that's لو سمحت ممكن أفكر الدريشة. And in Egyptian Arabic, you say إثل الشباك, which are not only a different verb, but a different noun, and it's a different language in some cases.
Hmm. In this sort of relative polyglot, are they sensitive to, okay, this person has come from somewhere else, or do people just look at you like, what did you just say to me?
There's a little bit of, like, wide-eyed blinking. But, you know, people like the constant question, especially somewhere like Egypt, is where are you from?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people really love to guess. So, you know, I spent, you know, almost 5 years just having people guess where I was from and avoiding answering because it was just didn't have the energy to answer anything. Honestly.
Yeah, you write about somebody who said, I don't know, are you Italian? Are you, like, they didn't, American was like the furthest thing from their list.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, obviously Egypt is very special because it has, I mean, it's special for a thousand reasons, but they, in terms of regionally, Egyptians are very familiar with people from all over the world coming through. So, you know, of course they would guess Italian and Spanish and Greek and any number of other things before they came around to Moroccan or whatever else.
We have an email here from Amanda who says, when Sophia said halfy, that reminded me of when I visited my father's country. They refer to me as the half-caste. Though they always treated me with such love and generosity, they kind of always unknowingly made me feel I am not fully one of them. Did you experience anything like that? Was that your sense from your family at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, actually, because on the reverse side of that, one of the early names for this book was going, I don't know if I can, but it was Dunkoon, because that was something that my mother's extended family in Washington State used to jokingly but lovingly sort of jest about our dad and about us and the men in my mother's on my mother's side. And it was a sort of interesting reversal because on the opposite side in my dad's Arab family, they would never say anything, but you would always sort of feel that there was a difference. But on both sides, I've only ever experienced, you know, love and even if it is with a sort of winking joke of us being very different or very sort of unassimilatable, if that's a word. But yeah,
1-800.
It's an interesting thing. I really agree with Amanda.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Nora on the telephone in Plano. Hi, Nora.
Hello. I have a question for you. Hi. I am a first-generation Mexican in the United States, and what I encountered going back to my home country, visiting relatives and cousins and things, I was perceived to, because I lived in the United States, people perceived that I was not as conservative, that some aunts, distant relatives would think I was a bad influence on their daughters because of misconceptions of what they think the West or the United States is about their morals and things like that. Did you encounter the same going back home?
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing. In a way, the way that I experienced what morally be happening is through my mother's assumptions of what was morally correct for us to be doing. So she's the obviously the American influence in that case, and she's in so many ways more strict than my father is with us. And then, of course, when we went back to the Gulf, I mean, it's very much a similar situation, I think. Like I was mentioning before with the pop cultural references of, like, you know, us staying up late watching horror movies, American horror movies, being like a, you know, a really, really fun thing. But that sort of moral thing about America, like a bad sort of influence of America, didn't really, honestly, like, it wasn't something that I experienced so much. Again, I think that they were very innocent in a way to what that meant, what America was like. I mean, they thought that America, I mean, my grandmother thought that she could drive to the States. So I think that only in very recent years, with more of an exposure to satellite television stuff, people started to think, oh, you know, like, is it like the music videos? Is it like, you know, is it all drinking and drugs and rock and roll? So, so yes and no. But really interesting question, because I think it's a common thing that people feel.
We talked earlier about your sort of exploration of different things that you wanted to wear in high school, and your surprise at feeling in some ways liberated by wearing abaya. I wonder if in some ways now putting on particular clothes gives you a sense, sort of grounds you in the place you are, in the culture you are at that moment, and if it sort of makes it easier for you to transition from the Gulf to the West.
Yes, that's a really interesting question. I mentioned before that the wearing of abaya in my you know professional life is something that is very, very much, you know, gives me a place, you know, allows me to function in a certain way in the Gulf. And so yeah, I mean, it absolutely does. I find that as I get older, though, I want to streamline. So, for example, I will wear all black all the time, no matter where I am, just because it's easier to coordinate with when I go back to Doha and I'm wearing my abaya. You know, it's like simple stuff like that, you know, just like practicality. But, yeah, there are fashion issues.
We just have a few seconds left, but I wonder if you discovered anything about yourself in writing this book that you hadn't thought of before.
I really discovered how difficult it was to retread old turf, but I'm very grateful that I did, and I've had amazing response that's been very cathartic for me, so thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Sophia Almeria is a writer, artist, and filmmaker. Her new memoir is called The Girl Who Fell to Earth. Sophia, it's been great to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions as well. Email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.